In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code Spotify for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Why is it that with sparkling water, I'm always playing guessing games with what flavor I'm drinking? Is it citrus? Is it aluminum can flavored? Not sure. Sparkling ice, though, they really mean flavor. Like in-your-face flavor. Orange mango, black raspberry. Don't even get me started on the strawberry lemonade. Kiwi strawberry slid right into my taste buds' DMs last night and let them know who's boss. No subtleties there and no sugar either. But it does have vitamins and antioxidants. Find sparkling ice at a major grocery store or club retailer near you. Sparkling ice. Anything but subtle.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Don't turn your back on the lions. That's what his friends in the circus kept telling the great Masati. But Masati, otherwise known as Thomas McCarthy, didn't listen. He thought he was invincible. He'd survived a decade in the cages with the beasts, although admittedly he had lost an arm to them a few years back. Also, he'd had a few drinks tonight and was feeling unusually careless and venturesome. The circus was full. The big top was bristling with excitement. The people of Bolton had come out in force on this winter's night in 1872, and Masati was going to put on a show for them. He stepped into the ring, wearing his leopard skin outfit with a sword in his one good arm. He was also packing a revolver loaded with a blank cartridge. He may have been reckless, but he was not mad. Masati whipped up the crowd with a description of what he was about to do. And then into the lion's den he went. There were five of the beasts inside. He knew how to make them bend to his will, and soon they were leaping through hoops on his command. The crowd roared in appreciation. But then Masati noticed that one of the lions was restive and growling. He turned. He pointed his sword threateningly at its mouth. He had to show the lion who was in charge. That was a terrible blunder. While his attention was diverted, a second lion leapt onto his back and he felt a searing pain run through his scalp. Mayhem erupted in the big top. People were screaming, men were running in search of weapons, and nobody was keeping a cool head. Masati fought back, slashing the lions with his sword, while spectators tried to push the animals back with pistols and brooms. But the lions were frenzied. One of them bit deep into his arm, fracturing the bones, while another tore into his thigh. Masati screamed for help. And finally, the big cats were restrained, pushed back with partitions deep into their cage. But then, horrifyingly, as Masati tried to claw himself away, the lions came again and he was dragged back into their den. Amazingly, he was still conscious when he was finally rescued. But in the infirmary, he really didn't have much chance. He had awful lacerations and broken bones. He died soon after. That is not the sort of work experience that would encourage many people to consider a career change. But Bob Carlyle spotted a vacancy and applied for the role. From History Extra, this is The Tiger Tamer Who Went to Sea, the amazing life of Bob Carlyle, Victorian sailor, showman, and sportsman extraordinaire. I'm David Musgrove, and I'd like to introduce you to Bob Carlyle. This is episode 3. Would you let a tiger lick your face? Well, would you? That's the question for this episode. Would you let a tiger lick your face? I'm pretty sure I wouldn't. I don't even let my friendly Labrador lick my face. But then I know where she puts her snout. Bob Carlyle, on the other hand, was quite happy to go cheek to cheek with big cats, despite what he knew of the grisly fate of Masati and several other lion tamers at the time. The thing is, he was a born showman and he wanted to make his mark in the circus business. In the last episode, we heard about Carlyle's seafaring career and his many close calls on the high seas. This time, we're going to hear about some very different risks that he faced in the big top, and we're going to take a deep dive into the world of the travelling Victorian circus. Before we do, there's one little episode that we skipped over last time, which was Carlyle's brief career on the railways. In the early 1870s, fresh from his first foray as a sailor, he got a job cleaning engines on the Caledonian Railway. He did that for a few months before transferring to a role in the parcels office of the North British Railway. That is surely the least interesting bit of employment that our man has in his long career. And unsurprisingly, he didn't stick at it for long. Now, the railways were just as dangerous as the high seas. Carlyle managed to have yet another death-defying scrape when he fell off a wagon, grabbed onto the coupling, which prevented him being cut to pieces on the metals. Later, he was nearly mown down by the Glasgow-Edinburgh Express while he was on board what I assume was a modest little engine on the side. He escaped being knocked into smithereens by jumping at the last minute into a siding. Exciting stuff. Carlyle notes in his autobiography that the railroad is a good place for a good, steady man. And Carlyle's problem was that he was not a steady man. Bob Carlyle was not one to stick to a job. He wanted adventure. He wanted to join the circus. And in fact, there was a link between railways and circuses, as Dr. John Wolfe, historian of the Victorian travelling circus, explained to me.
Travelling circuses had been around for centuries, if we see travelling circuses as part of the travelling fairs. I mean, they're rooted in the ancient times, and I mean, even certain circus acts take us back to the ancient period. But it was really sort of late 18th century, you have the kind of birth of the modern circus as we would understand it. And the travelling circus as a feature of British life really starts coming to predominance in the early 19th century, and it becomes a commercialised phenomenon by the middle of the 19th century. It's that point, really, that the circus is on the cultural map, if you like, of Victorian Britain.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match. With Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Whether you're making a delicious family meal or a post-workout snack, choose the farm-fresh taste of Eggland's Best Eggs. Only Eggland's Best Hens are fed their proprietary all-vegetarian feed. That's what makes their eggs more nutritious. With 10 times more vitamin E, 25% less saturated fat, and 6 times more vitamin D compared to ordinary eggs. Eggland's Best. Better taste, better nutrition, better eggs. Visit egglandsbest.com to learn more.
New year, new credit scores. Chime makes it easier to build credit using your own money and on-time payments with the secure Chime Credit Builder Visa Credit Card. Use it everywhere Visa credit cards are accepted. To apply, just open a Chime checking account with a qualifying direct deposit. There's no annual fee or credit check required when applying. Get started at Chime.com/build. That's Chime.com/build. The Chime Credit Builder Visa Credit Card is issued by Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A. Members FDIC. Late payment may negatively impact your credit score. Results may vary.
So Bob Carlyle quit the railway and went back to Edinburgh. And there he was attracted, moth to the flame, to a certain Mr. Newsome of Newsome's Circus. If you remember, as a boy, Carlyle loved the circus. But now he was a man, and something else had changed too. He had money. At the age of 22, he'd inherited £400 from the estate of his much-missed grandfather. How much was £400 worth, you might be wondering? Well, if we're comparing it to typical wages, then £400 in 1870 is really more like £260,000 to £340,000 today, depending on what metric you use. So a very considerable amount of cash. It was a windfall that opened up some opportunities for Bob to pursue a life that he'd always hankered after. So he offered to invest in Newsome Circus, though it doesn't sound like he did that much due diligence before proposing the deal. Newsome's response, as recorded by Carlyle, suggests that he was a very honest man, because the old circus pro told the naive young potential investor that he was doing bad business at the time and would not like him to invest it and lose it. Undeterred, and seemingly desperate to make something of his inheritance, Carlyle promptly found another circus man, Mr. John Swallow, to invest with. Adverts in the stage paper The Era note the itinerary of Swallow and Carlyle's circus in the autumn of 1871. But it wasn't to be a good partnership. Carlyle left the company before the winter was out, in bad shape financially.
"The winter of the following year smashed us both,"
notes Carlyle ruefully. What was it about the travelling circus that had Carlyle so hooked? Why was the experience so compelling to him? I asked John Wolfe to describe what it would be like to go to the circus in the 1870s.
"The thing that would hit you would be the noise. I think you'd really hear the noise. And there's lots of people there. You would hear the band possibly playing, a circus band, the brass kind of blasting through your ears. You'd feel the sort of muddy grass on your feet. There'd probably be smoke in the air, lots of people smoking cigars or cigarettes. There might even be, you know, candy stores and oyster stores outside. So you'd have the aroma of street food. And you'd go inside the tent and you'd get that kind of humidity feel. You might see the sawdust at the centre, get that slight smell of sawdust, and you'd feel the anticipation. This was so exciting. The wonder of the circus, like you're about to see miraculous human demonstrations of incredible strength and agility and speed, and, you know, you might even hear a lion or an elephant. It would be a sensory assault."
The way John tells it, you can see what drew Carlyle to the big top. Even so, a setback like the one with Swallow Circus might have brought an early halt to a lesser man's enthusiasm for the showman's life. Not so Bob Carlyle. He signed up to be a clown in the Ginnett Brothers Grand Circus and spent the following winter with them in Coventry. In his autobiography, he even gives us a sample of what he said. He had some riddles and some conundrums. So let me try a couple on you.
"Why is a policeman worse than the devil? We are given to believe that when we die, if we are wicked, the devil takes our souls. But if we get drunk and kick up a row, the policeman comes and walks away with soul and body, old clothes and all."
No, doesn't really land these days, does it? How about this one?
"Why is a policeman like a rainbow? Because he never appears until the storm is over."
Bit better? Last one.
"When did Scotland lose one of her most precious stones? When she lost her living stone."
That one really only works if you've got a decent understanding of geography of Scottish towns. I'll leave it to you to decide if you're amused or not. Dr. Bob Nicholson, as well as being an expert on Victorian newspapers, is an authority on the 19th century sense of humour and curator of the Old Joke Archive on social media. I asked him for his views on Carlyle's comedic efforts.
"Clowns at the time were almost akin to stand-up comedians. We now think of clowns as being very much engaged in slapstick physical humour, you know, loads of them being crammed in a car or, you know, falling over or something like that. But in the 19th century, they were very much engaged in storytelling, in cracking jokes. As for his actual material, for my sins, I've probably read thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of Victorian jokes. I would say his efforts are middling. You know, they're not necessarily the best I've seen, not necessarily the worst. He seems to have had quite a few conundrum jokes, which are kind of question and answer jokes, almost kind of like mini riddles. They were hugely popular in the 19th century. You would have these travelling shows would often do these massive conundrum competitions where local readers would like send in their best ones and they'd be performed on stage. So he's very much like working in the tradition of Victorian comedy. He'd have a few conundrums. He'll have a bit of comic poetry. He'll have a maybe slightly more emotional, you know, story as well thrown in there. I suspect he wasn't an amazing clown, but nevertheless, you know, he's very much doing what clowns did at the time. And yeah, I guess good on him for having been brave enough to have a go at it.
So that all begs the question of what really made the Victorians laugh.
Oh, the Victorians love a really wide range of types of humour. The classic stereotype is that they are, you know, not amused, but that could not be further from the truth. I mean, they love puns, particularly that, I mean, they really love incredibly torturous wordplay. So I'll give you an example. This is a joke from a joke book, literally called Punniana, which is 400 pages of puns, all as bad as the one I'm about to tell you. And it goes, if you were to kill a conversational goose, what vegetable would it allude to? Asparagus or asparagus. I mean, like terrible, terrible wordplay, but they love this stuff. You see these in newspapers, you know, in comedy routines, people would take them to dinner parties. So they love a pun. They love, I guess what we might term kind of character little sketches, you know, jokes about cliches, you know, jokes about unscrupulous lawyers or doctors or milkmen or all these kind of things. You know, they love those kind of little story jokes. They do quite enjoy a bit of slapstick humour as well. Quite a lot of them enjoy practical jokes. You know, they have as varied a sense of humour, I would say, as we do now. But yeah, if there's one type, I would say the pun is the quintessential Victorian form of comedy.
Armed with that stack of riddles and conundrums, Carlyle toured the Midlands with the Jinnett brothers. He would have been in the company of the likes of Amy Samwells, the elegant slackline artiste, and Oscar de Boer, the manfish, who delivered marvellous performances underwater. Carlyle seems to have worked himself into the circus community pretty quickly, despite not being a typical sort of circus showman.
He's not archetypal insofar as there were loads of different ways in which people entered the circus. So Bertram Mills entered the business as a result of a wager. You had the fairground showman, Billy Smart, who purchased a circus kind of to the wonder of his family. And someone like Jerry Cottle, who was the son of a stockbroker from London. And then you had the likes of Pablo Fanque, who was born in a workhouse and was apprenticed to the circus. So there was lots of different ways in which people entered the world of the circus. But, you know, Bob Carlyle's interest in the circus and that kind of desire to escape the constraints of his familial and social background was not uncommon.
Carlyle wasn't content with just one role in the circus, though. He went on to work for a waxworks in New York in the early winter of 1872, and then as an agent in advance for Bostock and Wanwell's circus and menagerie. Agent in advance is an interesting job, which he described as follows.
My duties were to go a week ahead of the show, see the bills posted and put in windows, work the newspapers, call at the school, and leave tickets for the children at one penny each, and arrange for ground, stabling and forage.
But there was another, darker side to the agent in advance job, as John Wolfe explained to me.
The agent in advance, someone like Bob Carlyle, that solitary job, going ahead of your circus outfit, those individuals were often prone to drink. It was commonplace and a recognised phenomenon. Drink was part and parcel of circus life as well, whether you were an agent in advance or not. It was part of the fairground world. But that wasn't true for everyone. I mean, Barnum was a teetotaler. He banned alcohol in his establishments. So, you know, you can't homogenise. It wasn't true across the board, but certainly early to mid-19th century, those travelling circuses, and particularly that agent in advance, drink was a part of that story.
We'll come back to the demon drink later on. But first, let's hear a little more about Carlyle's employers at the time, Bostock and Wanwell's, which was one of the most famous of the Victorian travelling circuses.
Wanwell's menagerie was probably the most famous menagerie of the Victorian era. And again, a bit like the circus and the freak show, emerged from the sort of travelling fairs and would travel round with the kind of fair circuit, if you like. And again, the menageries were interesting because initially it was about displaying exotic animals. But over time, you would then get sort of act with the animals, either the animals being made to perform or lion tamers, you know, associated with the menageries. And then over time, menageries and animal performances would enter the circus as well.
Just as an aside, the Edinburgh Evening News for Friday, 23rd August, 1873, has this surprising note for its readers.
On Wednesday morning, another addition was made to the menagerie of Messrs. Bostock and Wombwell by the birth of two cubs by a spotted hyena. The hyena occupied a den along with a Russian brown bear, and the young family is the progeny of the amiable pair. The hyena appears to be very fond of her offspring, but has become so vicious that it's necessary to keep the den boarded up. So far, as the proprietor, Mr. Bostock, is aware, this is without precedent.
Yeah, I'd agree that sounds unprecedented. I'm no expert in species crossbreeding, but I'd go so far as to say as that didn't happen. No doubt the idea was good for business for an exotic menagerie, though. Anyway, in the summer and autumn of 1872, Bostock and Wombwell's was in Wales, and then by November, it had travelled north. There's a newspaper report in the York Herald that describes the arrival of Bostock and Wombwell's menagerie in Darlington. It notes that a local physician contacted the local branch of the Society for the Protection of Cruelty to Animals about the state of a wounded wolf there.
Sadly, you know, animals were seen as commodities and often terribly treated, in poor conditions, poor food, chained to the floor. Yeah, actually, you know, really quite disturbing. And that was true across the piece, really. You know, P.T. Barnum, Carlisle, the animals weren't well treated or well kept at all. And, you know, often if they died, they would be displayed as dead, or, you know, that skeletons would be displayed. So, yeah, they were quite dispendable. I think if we looked at it today, through our modern sensibilities, we'd be aghast at the treatment of animals.
Carlisle swapped Bostock and Wombwell's for a stint with Simon's Menagerie in 1872. And it was at this point that he took on a new role, as a lion tamer. Now, this was a task for which it seems he had absolutely zero experience, though he had actually tried to get a gig as a lion tamer in 1872. He'd offered his services to Mrs. Manders in York because he knew that there was an opening, literally and tragically, of dead man's boots for an animal handler. That was after the harrowing demise of the Great Masati, which I outlined at the start of this podcast. And that was graphically reported in the page of the Leeds Mercury at the time. I spared you some of the details, but Carlisle would surely have known what happened to poor old Masati. Seemingly, this very real risk to life was not any sort of blocker to Bob Carlisle. In a later interview that he gave to a paper in 1906, he recalled just how laissez-faire he was about the whole thing.
"How did you get into the lion taming business?"
asked the reporter.
"I just took it up,"
replied Carlisle. It does seem somewhat remarkable that he was quite so relaxed in his dealings with big cats. So I checked in with John Wolfe to see if he knew much about the training regime that prospective animal trainers underwent. It wasn't, as he says, particularly rigorous.
I mean, again, this is a ballsy man. It was a bit of trial and error, the whole kind of learning how to tame lions and tigers. And you had the likes of Arthur Williams and Van Amber in America, who respectively stepped into the tradition or kind of trained within it. But Bob Carlisle, I mean, yeah, that's nuts. Very, very brave, a bit foolhardy. But, you know, again, the circus is all about that. It was all bravado, it was all show. Yeah, stupid but brave.
It's also worth saying that in his first autobiography, Carlisle notes that he entered the lion's cage half drunk. Clearly a risky business, thinking back to the demise of Masati. That's the first time he mentions alcohol, but it's not the last. Let's go back to that 1906 paper interview again.
"But were you not afraid to tackle a cage of lions with little or no experience of them?"
responds the surprised journalist.
"To tell the truth, I have met with some heavy disappointments at the time, and I was not caring very much what I risked."
"But how did you feel the first time you were amongst the lions?"
"I did not think much about it at all. I followed the directions of the man I was working for, and everything passed off smoothly. Only once the lion lost his temper. One day it jumped up my arm, caught me with his teeth, but drew no blood. It was bad enough as it was, and while he had the grip, my arm just felt as if it were being squeezed in a vice."
In that interview,
Carlyle made reference to having had some very heavy disappointments and not caring what he risked. I wonder if that fatalism was the result of his losing the legacy that he'd inherited. Carlyle had met up again with Mr. Swallow in Glasgow when he was with Jeanette's the previous year and received 48 sovereigns, which was the balance of what Swallow owed him in the aftermath of their failed partnership. We don't know how much he initially invested, but it sounds like the majority of his £400 might have been lost. From here on in, Carlyle's story is one of a continual struggle for money. He seems to find lots of ways to make it, but he also seems to find quite a few ways to spend it. After passing through a few more circuses, he was with Manley's Great American Circus in the Lake District in September 1873, and described as the American clown and jester. If you remember from episode 2, Carlyle had been to America a few years previously, but he definitely was not an American. I asked John Wolfe to put forward a view as to why Carlyle might have been pitching himself as someone from across the pond.
My wager is he did that because being American made him more exotic. It made him more different. It made him a bit more out there. And that was the raison d'etre of the circus. It was a space of exoticism, difference, otherness. But of course, America was also known to be this big country with big people and big circuses. So by proclaiming himself as an American, he's also kind of placing himself within the lineage of the great P.T. Barnum and Buffalo Bill and James Bailey. So quite a clever bit of marketing, that really.
After this, Carlyle leapt between circus outfits and circus jobs with remarkable regularity. And this was standard practice, according to John Wolfe.
Bob Carlyle is essentially a freelancer, self-employed, and that was really common in the world of the circus. It was a kind of transitory life in the circus, but also with, you know, different circus proprietors.
After a time, he ended up back with Bostock's, but then he hit a problem, a drink problem. He admits in his autobiography that he gave way to drink. He recovered enough from his drinking to make it to Sunderland to join Talliot Circus for the winter of 1874-75. The audiences there were treated to Little Tony, the champion dancer, and Rivali, the fire princess. Sounds amazing. He travelled through Scotland with them, with Carlyle acting the clown for the troupe. He spoke glowingly of the scenery of the far northeast, but then, when he got to Wick, he tells us that he once more got drunk, had some words, and left. It's at that point that he signs up for the terrifying herring run to Hamburg on board the Jane and Anne, which we talked about in episode 2. Once he was back on dry land again after that, it's perhaps not too much of a surprise to hear that he turned to drink once more. But he was soon on the road again, this time back with Bostock and Womwells in Huddersfield. At Bostock's, Carlyle was working with the animals once more. He describes his performance routine. First he
entered the cage of hyenas, bears and wolves, and made them leap over a gate, made the bear stand on his hind legs and take a piece of sugar from my mouth, and concluded by making the hyenas leap through a hoop of fire. I next entered the Bengal tiger's cage and stood up in the corner of it. The tiger made a spring, placed a paw on each shoulder, and gave me a kiss, his tongue being as rough as a file. This was a very affectionate animal. But like many good things, he did not last long, dying of consumption. The last den performance was among a group of lions. I did a dash into the cage, ran the animals around it, and then came out, the lions after me, to the door. I then conducted a performance of the American war elephant, who played a mouth organ, a barrel organ, stood on side legs, cross legs, walked over me twice, and lifted me up on her head with her trunk.
Frankly, it all sounds utterly terrifying and not that good for the animals. Carlyle and that menagerie overwintered in Liverpool before heading out to Wales in the spring. But there he once more succumbed to his old enemy drink. He left the circus at Neath and sold all his possessions, returning to Liverpool after committing what he says was a great blunder. He had £10 from the sale of his chattels and he used it to get so drunk in the city that he was locked up in Dale Street and fined 5 shillings. It was at this point, as his autobiography abruptly notes, he got married. His wife doesn't even merit a name, nor indeed a full sentence. In his second autobiography, he omits to mention the marriage at all. However, we know from his marriage certificate that on 29 May 1876, in Toxteth, he was wed to Mary Freeman, She was 19, he was 27. We hear nothing more of marital matters until 1880, when Carlyle relays to his readers that he went to Exeter, where he had left his poor wife and two children in debt. It won't surprise you to hear that their married life was not particularly settled. Carlyle was soon on the road again. In the spring of 1877, Carlyle was in London with Mr. George Sanger at Astley's Amphitheatre on Westminster Bridge Road. His role there was keeper of two lions, one lioness and two tigers. He describes George Sanger as the Barnum of England. So I asked John Wolfe for a bit more information about him.
The likes of George Sanger and P.T. Barnum recognised the importance of appealing to the middle classes. And so they imbued their shows with greater respectability. They deliberately targeted the middle classes, while at the same time, the travelling fares were increasingly suppressed through legislation. So you had this sort of shift in the spaces in which circuses were performed and in the advertising of circuses to a new, more middle-class clientele, which meant that by the middle to the late 19th century, circus performers were household names and largely seen as, I wouldn't say a respectable profession, but it wasn't looked down upon like it was in the early 19th century.
The question of how respectable the circus profession was is one that clearly weighed on Carlyle's mind. He talks glowingly in the introduction to his autobiography about the show people that he travelled with and suggests that they are unfairly viewed by society. In fact, we know that he went so far as to agitate on their behalf. Here's a letter that he wrote a few years later to the Newcastle Daily Chronicle.
Sirs, I see in the papers that Messrs. Burt and Fenwick, MPs, introduced a tyrannical bill against the van dwellers. It seems strange that men who have been raised from the ranks, who are the advocates in the liberty to the pitmen, should seek to deprive showmen of their rights and liberties.
Reference here is being made, I imagine, to the Temporary Dwellings Bill and the Movable Dwellings Bill. These efforts at passing a movable or temporary dwellings bill through Parliament between 1885 and 1895 were a formative experience for Showland, which, according to Elijah Bell in a fascinating doctoral thesis on travelling show people, were attempts to regulate and reform the itinerant population of Great Britain, supposedly to improve sanitary conditions of van dwellers and ensure all itinerant children could access education. This was a subject close to Carlyle's heart, and it's interesting to see him politically active here and standing up for the interests of the travelling community. It sounds like he felt it keenly that there was a sense of persecution from society against the travelling life. Back to John Wolfe.
So the Metropolitan Police formed in 1829, and you had the Vagrants Act of 1824, I think it was, and a whole series of acts up to the middle of the 19th century, which gave the police powers to clamp down on the fares and stop them from occurring within certain localities. So increasingly, it became much harder for the fares to survive because legislation and the arm of the state came down hard on them. Because they were associated with, like we say, drunkenness, prostitution, criminality, and all the things that appalled middle-class Victorians.
Carlyle was soon on tour again with Bostock and Wanwell, taking a menagerie of five cages of animals through Berkshire, Wiltshire, Devon and Cornwall. He notes how at one stop in the middle of nowhere, the prospect of a good crowd seemed remote, but suddenly the local farmers started to make an appearance in all sorts of conveyances, one old man being brought in a wheelbarrow. That may have sparked an idea in Bob Carlyle. Anyway, the circus found its way to St Austell in Cornwall, and that's where Carlyle's drinking got him in trouble once more, as he admits that he left at St Austell for getting drunk and walking a young tiger through the street without a muzzle. Now, we've talked about that before, and it can't have been an everyday occurrence in the Cornish China Clay town. But sadly, I couldn't find any newspaper reports to corroborate that story. True or not, the indiscretion was seemingly one too many for Bostock and Wanwell, and Bob was forced to seek new means of making money.
I bade farewell to the lion, the pet tiger who licked my face with his tongue, and gazed into my face with his large, lustrous eyes, eyes which in their brilliance outdazzled the diamond, my old friend the elephant, the leopards, bears, wolves, and hyenas, another blunder deeply regretted since.
As that snippet from his second autobiography shows, Carlyle was both oddly love-struck with the tiger and full of regret, wallowing in self-pity. His own words show that he was not in a good place, full of remorse for his actions. He needed a new start. He got one from an American.
I settled painting for a few months in St. Austell, went occasionally to Baptist Chapel as a self-righteous hypocrite, finding fault with everyone but myself. When E.P. Weston, the American pedestrian, went through the country on his 2,000 miles walk, I started to walk.
Next time, we'll see where Bob Carlyle's walking takes him. That was episode 3 of History Extra's The Tiger Tamer Who Went to Sea. If you'd like to know more about Victorian travelling circuses and fairs, you can watch an extended bonus interview on the subject with Dr. John Wolfe, if you're a History Extra member. Go to historyextra.com/tiger-tamer-series. This is a History Extra production, researched, written and hosted by me, David Musgrove. My colleagues Rhiannon Davis, Ellie Cawthorn, Eleanor Evans and Rob Attar improved the script. Dr. Bob Nicholson kindly gave it a read through, and the producer was Jack Bateman. My experts in this series are Professor Valerie Sanders, Dr. Bob Nicholson, Dr. Anne-Marie McAllister, Dr. Martin Wilcox, Dr. John Wolfe, and Professor Dave Day. Thanks also to Sarah Williams, editor of Who Do You Think You Are magazine, for her help with untangling the genealogy. I'm also grateful to Chris Godfrey-Morell and Ken Bogle of Midlothian Council Library Service for helping to find the Black Collection in their archive. I owe thanks to Craig Statham, formerly of East Lothian Archives, and Hanita Ritchie in the John Gray Centre there, who helped me to track down some local records in East Lothian, Lisa D. Tommaso, librarian at the Murab Library in Penzance, and Linda Camage of the Penwith Local History Group were also generous with their time. The Museum of Cornish Life in Helston put me in touch with the wheelwright Terry Ansell, who helped me to understand more about Victorian wheelbarrows generally. Numerous other historians answered curious questions from me, including Dr. Richard Scully, Professor Nicholas Croson, Professor Rosalind Crone, and Dr. Vanessa Heggie. Finally, if you're interested in studying archive newspaper sources yourself, as a History Extra podcast listener, you can get a 10% discount on subscription to the British Newspaper Archive. Just go to britishnewspaperarchive.co.uk and use the code BNAHIST24 at checkout. And that offer is valid until 31 July 2024.